This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
That she converts Reform, it'll be much quicker. He says, no, she says she wants to convert Orthodox. They have a discussion anyway. That all he wants is Reform, it's okay. But she finds it very difficult to understand. Studies for a couple of weeks, and then she goes through a symbolic immersion in a symbolic sort of a mikveh, and she comes out and they say that you're Jewish now. And she doesn't understand this at all. So the first Friday night, they're sitting down to supper, and she gives him fish. And after the fish, she's about to... He says, what's after the fish? She looks at the cutlery. She says, no, this is the main course. He says, that's my mother used to give us chicken on Friday night, not fish. She says, oh, no problem. She brings out a basin of water. She dips the fish into the water. She puts it back on his plate. He says, and what's all this about? She says, I was a goy, they dipped me into the water, and they said, now you're a Jew. This was a fish, I dipped it into the water, now it's chicken. What we're going to do this evening is understand the mechanism of conversion. What does it do? How can one change? What kind of a change is that? Is it possible to change? If the difference between Jew and Gentile is so fundamental, it's not just a difference in belief. It's a difference in something so fundamental. It's not even just a difference in culture. The Kuzari goes so far as to say it's a different species. It's not even the same species. The Jew and Gentile are so fundamentally different. If that is so, then that woman's quite right. If you can change a fish, if you can change a Gentile into a Jew, you can change a fish into a chicken. What is this process of change that can produce so drastic, so dramatic a change as from a Gentile to a Jew, whereas in all other areas we don't find such changes possible? The first mitzvah we have in the parasha this week requires that when we come to Eretz Yisrael and we're producing fruits and so on, the first fruits that are produced of the Shiva Saminim, of the seven species, we have to bring, as Bikurim, we have to bring to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple, and we give those Bikurim, so to say, we give them to God, and God gives it to the Kohen. But what's important is that not only do we have to bring them, that's been stated previously in the Torah, what our parasha teaches us is that in addition to bringing these Bikurim, in addition to bringing these first fruits, there's a whole procedure that we have to go through. You shall bring the fruits, at least one of each species, of each of the seven species, and you were to put them in a basket. And you go to the place of Yerushalayim, and you come before the Kohen, and you say to him as follows. And it's quoted, it has to be said word for word. The Torah then gives the whole thing that you have to say. Higadati hayoim lahashem elokecha, I have told God this day, that I have finally come to the land that God swore to us to give to us, swore to our fathers to give to us. And the Kohen will take the basket from your hands and he'll put it in front of the altar, and then you'll say, then you retrace your whole history. Originally there was an Aramite who wanted to destroy my father, and he went down to Egypt and he lived there as a small nation, and he became a very big nation. And the Egyptians tortured us and caused us to suffer and gave us hard labor. We cried to God our Father, and he heard our cries and he saw our suffering. We read all this in the Haggadah on Pesach. And Hashem took us out from Egypt with a strong hand and an outstretched arm, and with great wonder and signs and miracles. And he brought us to this land, and he gave us this land flowing with milk and honey. And now I've brought the first fruits, etc., etc. That's the first mitzvah that we have in the Seder today. The Mishnah says in Bikurim, in the first Perek, the fourth Mishnah, Elu Meviim Veloi Kurim. There are some people who are not qualified to bring Bikurim. for various different reasons. They're not qualified to bring Bikurim. And the earlier Mishnah lists some of them. Irisim, if one's working as an agent, it's not one's own field. All sorts of situations where you can't, or Gazlon, you've got stolen fruit. All sorts of situations where you can't bring Bikurim. But Elu Mevi'in Velo Kurim, there are some people who have to bring Bikurim, they have to bring their first fruits, but they can't recite this passage. Hager Mevi Ve'ino Kure. And the first such person listed by the Mishnah is a Ger, a convert. He must bring Bikurim if he's got property in Eretz Yisrael, and he brings the first fruit, that's in order. But he can't say this passage. She'en yochol loymar asher nishba Hashem la'aseinu loses lonu. Because he cannot say it, that's not true. He says, I've come to the land which God swore to our fathers to give to us. Higadati ayom la'Hashem elokecho ki vosi el ha'oretz. I have come to the land which God swore to our fathers to give to us. That a Gary can't say. It wasn't sworn to his fathers. He doesn't have a biological connection with Avraham, with Yitzchak, and with Yaakov. And therefore it's inaccurate. And we can't alter the wording at all. The wording is absolutely required without any kind of deviation. So he can't say this passage. And on the basis of that, Rabbeinu Tam paskens in the Tosfos in Bava Basra on Daf Pei Aleph, there are other things a Ger also can't say. He can't bench, because it says in the benching also, Asher hinchalto la'aviseinu, the land, the good land which you have given to our fathers. It's not his fathers, he can't say it. And even when he's davening in shul, says Rabbeinu Tam, there are certain alterations, there are certain differences that he has to say in his davening. Where we say Elokei Avoseinu, the God of our fathers, he's got to say Elokei Avos Yisrael, the God of the fathers of Israel. And if he's davening on his own. If he's davening in a shul, says Rabbeinu Tam, he's got to say Elokei Avoseichem, God of your fathers, not of my fathers. That's how the Rabbeinu Tam paskens. And the Ri disagrees. And he disagrees on the basis of a Yerushalmi. On this very Mishnah, the Yerushalmi says the following. Tani b'shem Rabbi Yehuda, we learnt in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, Geir atzmo mevi v'kore, a geir, a convert, not only can he bring these bikurim, but he can read it. It's not inaccurate. Matam. How come? How can he read it? Ki av hamoin goyim nesaticha. Because Hashem, when God changes Avram's name from Avram to Avraham, He changes and says, before you were Avram, meaning you were the father of the people of Aram, and now you are Avraham, you are father of Hamoin, Ham, meaning Hamoin Goyim, you are now the father of multitudes of nations. You're no longer the father of the people of Aram, but you're the father of a multitude of nations. Mikan ve'el le'she'over ha'yiso av le'oram, explains the Gemara in the Yerushalmi. Previously, you were the father of Aram. Ve'achshav mikan ve'elech ata av le'chol ha'goyim. Now you are the father of all nations. That doesn't mean all non-Jewish nations, but it means that you are the father of any person belonging to one of the non-Jewish nations who opts to convert. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi Omar, halocha k'Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, the law is like Rabbi Yehuda, that a ger can say it, a convert can say this passage. Ata uvde kumi Rabbi Avohu, there was in fact a case that came before Rabbi Avohu, v'hoiri k'Rabbi Yehuda, and he paskened like Rabbi Yehuda, so we have a precedent as well for Rabbi Yehuda. So even though our Mishnah states categorically that a ger cannot say this passage, we have another view recorded in the Yerushalmi, and the Yerushalmi says the halacha is that way, and therefore Rabbeinu Tam paskens that a ger says the same davening that we do. He says, Elokei Avoseinu, God of our fathers. He doesn't have to say your fathers or the fathers of Israel, because Avraham Avinu is his father. And he can say this passage as well. There's an interesting discussion also, just as an aside, in the Rishonim, as he's here, it says that he doesn't just say, who is his father? Avraham is his father. But it doesn't say, I've come to the land which you swore to my father. It says to my fathers. And who do we mean? To our fathers. We mean Avraham, Yitzchak and Yaakov. So there's an interesting discussion. What about Yitzchak and Yaakov? How can the Geir say, how can the convert say, the God of my fathers? Avraham is my father, but Yitzchak and Yaakov are not my fathers. So the Ramban says, no, Yitzchak and Yaakov also are Geir's fathers. When Hashem made Avraham the father of all converts. It wasn't just Avraham that was the father. Yitzchok took that position over, and Yaakov took that position over. And so Avraham, Yitzchok, and Yaakov, says the Ramban, are all fathers of the Gerim. The Shagas Aryeh explains, there's an interesting Shagas Aryeh based on what we were doing in last week's shir, the relationship between our distant cousins. We talked last week about whether you can resign from a family, and we talked about Edom and how Edom resigned. Esau's family resigned from our relationship. The Shagas Aryeh goes into a long discussion about whether the Bnei Yishmael, whether the Arabs are still cousins of ours or not. And there's certain Nachkiminis and Halacha, for example, they have a tradition to have a bris. Where does that tradition come from? From their grandfather Avraham, the same place that ours come from. In that case, is it a mitzvah for a mohel to do a bris for an Arab if he wants it? And he goes into the whole discussion as to what the relationship is between Bnei Yishmael and ourselves. And in that tshuva on Simon Memtes, he says that the Rambam holds, no, only Avraham is the father of the Gerim. But nevertheless, since the land was initially given to Avraham, it's in reference to that the Ger says, the land which you swore to our fathers, meaning primarily to Avraham, who is my father too. Be that as it may, what we need to understand is, what does this mean that Avraham becomes the father of the Gerim? What is a father? A father generates. A father generates generations. He generates children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. There has to be some kind of physical link between a descendant and an ascendant. How can we talk about Avraham becoming, back to the chicken and the fish kind of thing, so a particular person decides to convert? Okay. I understand what that means if it means that he takes on a new faith. A person takes on a new faith. He used to believe in one thing, now he believes in something else. Or he didn't believe in anything, now he believes in God. Fine, I can understand that. But that's a ger toshav, that's not a ger tzedek. A ger toshav is a person who decides to remain a non-Jew, but he takes on the beliefs of the Jewish people. He believes in one God, and he believes that the Torah is true, but he doesn't become Jewish, and therefore he's not obligated to keep the mitzvahs that a Jew is obligated to keep. He only has to keep the Noahide laws. So I can understand the ger toshav. The person remains a non-Jew as he was born, but gives up non-Jewish beliefs in favor of Jewish beliefs. That's fine. Easy to understand. I can understand the switch of nationality. A person decides to live, to take on a citizenship in a particular country. I can even understand to some extent a certain cultural reorientation, although that's getting a little bit more difficult to understand how a person can switch cultures. How do you switch a culture? The fact is, you are the product of thousands of years of culture. How can you switch that? But to become a descendant of somebody that you're not related to, that I find difficult to understand. That Avraham can be made the father of the Ger. How does it work? How does that operate? And this is just another instance of how we're willing to take absurdities from the Torah. When we read that, when we learn that, it looks absurd. But we don't question it. What does it mean? How is it possible? What does the Torah mean? What does the Gemara mean when it talks about Avraham as being the father? I can understand him being the patron of Gerim. I can understand him being whatever you want, the man who looks after Gerim, who's concerned about Gerim, whatever you want, the teacher of Gerim. But what does it mean he becomes the father of Gerim? How can he be the father of Gerim? What is the process of Gerus? What is it when a person converts? There's a beautiful piece in the Zohar in Parshas Lech Lecha. On that Tzadi Hei. The Zohar says the following. The Nichole Yosir Mikulu, Hashem loves the sacrifice of a bris. When a father mulls his child, when he circumcises his child, that sacrifice is worth more than any other sacrifices of Hashem. Dichtiv, as it says, V'zovachto alov es oilosecho v'shlomecho v'chol amokom asher azkir shemi, and the Zohar proves that is the case. From the juxtaposition of various psukim that revolve around the altar, around the Mizbech. Then he goes on to say, "V'im mizbeach avonim ta'aseli." If you're going to, the Torah says, if you're going to build an altar of stones, then it talks about you mustn't shape the stones with an iron implement and so on. Remez legiuro kadis gaya. This altar of stones, this stone, Mizbeach of stones, is a symbol of the convert who goes through a conversion process. De'ihu me'am k'shei k'dal u'k'shei libo. He's coming from a nation that are hard-necked and hard-hearted. Whatever that means. That there is a certain difference in essence between what he was and what he's going to become. Hay ikri mizbeach avoni. And that's what we talk about when we're talking about an altar made of stone. That's what we're talking about. Leitivne esen gazis. You can't make them from shaped bricks, from stones. Mahu, what's that all about? Deboi le'iolale befulchona dekud shabricha v'lo yigza yose. When a non-Jewish person wants to become inducted into the service of God, he must not have his bris. Ad the yinshi pulchona achro the ovad ad hocha. Until he has forgotten, until he has discarded the strange service that he used to serve until now. The yoadi mine hahu kashu deliba. And he's got to lose that hard-heartedness first. And we're not going to get into now into a discussion as to what that hard-heartedness means. But it's a cultural inherent quality that he had as part of the nation that he belonged to before, that he's got to be able to discard. It's an inherent quality that he has to be able to discard before he goes through the process of conversion. The E is gazar v'loy adi mine ha'okashya delibo. Lemeil befulchana kedisha de kutshabrichu. And if he has his bris and he has not yet removed that personality trait that is part of his previous culture, and he thinks that way he'll come into the service of God, harehu kahai pesilo de avno. He's still like a stone statue. The gazrile mehai gisa umehai gisa. You can carve the stone statue this way and that way, and you can give it the features of a Jew, or do whatever you want. The ishtoyer avna kidebekadmiso. But it still remains stone. You can change its form, but you can't change its essence. And to take a geir, to take a potential convert through the process of conversion, and giving him a bris, you're changing his external form. But he's still made of the same substance he was before. There hasn't been a change. Once again, we see clearly in this Zohar, the fact that the process of conversion is not just a change in beliefs, in behavior. It's not just a change in form. It's a change in substance. That the kashya deliba, that inherent quality that he had before, that hard-heartedness which was part of his earlier culture, has to be changed as if he was never part of that culture, before he goes through the bris. And now he becomes a person, so to say, made of different fabric, made of different substance to what he was before. It's a substantial change. In the literal sense of the words, it's a change of content. It's a change of what he's made from, not just a change of what he does and how he looks. It's not an external cosmetic operation. It's an internal change, a fundamental change of the makeup of the person. And that's very difficult to understand. How can you change a person? You can change his behavior, you can change his conduct, you can change his faith, you can change his external appearance, you can send him to a plastic surgeon and make him look like a Jew. You can do whatever you want on the outside, but how can you change the substance? And using the image that the Zohar is using, that a statue, no matter how much you carve it, it's still made of stone, implying that the conversion process is not one of carving, but changing from stone to a different substance. That's the kind of change it is. Much more than the fish to the chicken. It's from stone to a living substance. How does that happen? What is the process? We have a very interesting Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato that actually gives us insight into the process of change generally. He traces the origin of man and what God's intention was originally. As we know, the intention was that Adam would be an exceptional person, totally different to what the human being is today. Completely different being, on a different level of operation. That didn't work. Adam opted to come down a peg or two, or much more than a peg or two, according to Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, and he became a human in the way we know humans to be today. God then decided to give the world until the time of the Tower of Babel an opportunity to re-establish its root using and re-establish itself on the level of Adam. So until the time of the Tower of Babel, the Ramchal says, humanity had an opportunity to re-engineer its root. And had we done that, then again, there wouldn't have been a breakup into different nations. We would have had one universal nation of people. There wouldn't have been Jew and Gentile, and there certainly wouldn't have been different Gentile nations. There would have been one nation, all descended from one root, which was the ultimate of nobility and sanctity and so on, as was originally intended from Adam. Adam was originally intended that Adam would be the father of all people, be one race, one human race, and that would be the end of the story. That didn't work. And God gave until the time of the Tower of Babel. Humanity didn't rise to the occasion. And so at the Tower of Babel, God divided the world into 70 fundamental cultures. 70 different nations, each with its own language. And that wasn't just a linguistic division. That was giving each nation a new root and saying, okay, we no longer have the possibility of having one root for the whole of humanity. So we're now going to have 70 different trees, each with its own root, and each nation can now evolve the way it chooses. But no longer can the nations get back to their original intention that existed with Adam. That doesn't exist anymore. With one exception, and that was when the Torah was about to be given, God did go around to all the nations and gave them the opportunity for reincorporation, like we're going to give the TBVC states in South Africa. We're not going to give them the option, I suppose. They're going to be told. Anyway, the nations were given the opportunity to be reincorporated into one human race that would all function with the same value system and would all be governed by God, and we could get back to the Adam level. And again, that was turned down. Nobody opted for that. Among the 70 nations, one of the 70 trees was the Jewish people. And he left them the opportunity still to be able to rise to the Adam state. So now we have a situation after the time of the Tower of Babel of 70 different nations, 69 of them different from one another, but common in that none of them could get back to the pre-Adam state, or to the original state of Adam, and one nation, called the Jewish nation, that had within it the potential to be able to raise itself to that Adam state. And then he says as follows, Umirov tuvoi v'chastoi, but in Hashem's kindness and goodness, gozar v'nosan mokoim afilu la'anfei sha'ar ha'umus. Hashem decreed an allowed place even for the branches of other trees, shebevichirosoin umaaseihem, that through their free choice and their actions, yeakru atzmon mishorshon, are able to uproot themselves from their root, to detach themselves from their roots, veyuchlelu ba'anofov shel Avrohom Avinu, and to reattach themselves to the branches of Avrohom. In Yitzhak, if they want it. And that's what is meant when God made Avram the father of the Gerim. At least here we begin to see a hope of understanding it. We see that the Moshe Chaim Lutzato is trying to explain to us what this concept is of Avram becoming the father of the Gerim, the father of the converts. But how does it help us? It helps us by understanding that very image, the image of the trees. What he tells us is that a branch can detach itself from another tree and can attach itself to the tree of Avrohom. What does that mean? That's a process of grafting. That's what it is. The trees are living organisms, and the branches of each tree are similar to the tree from which they come because they're made of certain substances and they're being nourished by the trunk and by the roots of that particular tree. It's interesting, I'm not sure, perhaps there's somebody here who knows, if you would analyze the cell of a peach tree and an apple tree, from the trunk of the tree, or from a branch, or from a leaf, would there be a difference? Does anybody know? There would be a difference in every cell of the tree, if there would be a difference. But you'd be able to perceive, if one showed a scientist a cell, he would be able to say this is what comes from an apple tree or from a peach tree. Okay. So we have these different species, And we can take a branch from a peach tree and we can put it onto an apple tree. What did that produce then? Does it ever happen that you can graft it on and it carries on producing the apples? It produces, it becomes part of the new tree. That doesn't ever happen.
No, when you graft a peach onto some other stock, it grows peaches, it doesn't grow from the stock.
It grows what it used to be before.
No, it grows what the top part is, not what the bottom part is.
So if you take a branch from a peach tree and you put it onto an apple tree, it will carry on producing peaches. Interesting. Well, with humans it works different. We're not peach trees and apple trees. The grafting process, as far as humans are concerned, because, and very, very simply, if you take the cell of a Gentile, if you take a cell from the skin of a Gentile and the skin of a Jew, are you going to be able to determine a difference? No? So what is the difference? A peach tree and an apple tree, you can look at each cell and you'll find the difference. A Jew and a Gentile, you look at each cell and you won't find the difference. Explains that Ramchal, the difference is what he's being fed with. That's the difference. What he's being nourished with. The quality of his nourishment determines the fruit that he produces. These 70 different trees that God produced all came from Adam. The fact is they're inherently all one species. What happened at the Tower of Babel, dividing them into 70 different languages, means that their method, what is a language? A language is not just the way you communicate. A language is the way you perceive the world. A language is the mechanism you use to understand what's happening around you. And if you have a different way of terming things, if you have a different way of defining things and of relating things intellectually in the way your language operates, then your integration of the things around you differs one from the other. That's where human cultures differ. And so Hashem takes all this, all from Adam, so the physical structure of every human being is the same, can't tell the difference. He differentiates them by language and culture. And he allows them the opportunity to graft into the tree of Avrom. What happens if you graft into the tree of Avrom? The fabric is the same. But you're being nourished from the trunk of Avrom now, you're no longer being nourished from the trunk of another tree. And if you take a branch which is the same in its physical structure, and you graft it onto the tree of Avrom, then what you're becoming is you're becoming a descendant of Avrom, indistinguishable from the other descendants of Avrom. That's the mechanism that the Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzer describes to us. The process of conversion is not conversion at all. You don't take something and change it. What you do is you attach it to a source of nourishment different to the one from which it was being nourished previously. But the condition, the first condition is the detachment. You can't have it attached to two sources of nourishment. Then you get a mishmash. Then you get something which is totally destructive. But if it opts to detach itself first and to reattach itself, then the very essence of its being begins to change into something which has been nourished by the tree of Avraham Avinu. And that's what the Zohar means. To shape a non-Jew into a Jew doesn't help at all. What there has to be is he has to remove himself from his previous service. He has to remove himself from his previous source of input and attach himself to a new source of input. Then he can go through the externalisms of the bris and going to the mikveh and doing whatever has to be done, and he finds himself as a Jew. It's not a change from one object to another. It's the change of a human being being nurtured instead of from culture A, being nurtured from culture B. And the human being then has the capacity to take, to being nourished. Instead of being nourished from culture A, he's nourished from culture B, and he has the possibility of taking that nourishment and producing from it. That opens for us an important understanding regarding the development of people, the education of people, and the changing of people. At the time of the year people talk about teshuvah, about repenting and so on, people talk about it as some kind of a change process. But there isn't such a thing as a change process. You can't change people. So what is teshuvah? What are we talking about with teshuvah? What changes? And that's perhaps why teshuvah so often goes wrong. We all do teshuvah on Yom Kippur. We all decide all sorts of wonderful things on Yom Kippur. And within, as we often discuss, within 5 minutes of Yom Kippur being out, we're the same old people again, having gone through a nice experience, but there's no great difference. You go around to the Mutz Yom Kippur parties, you listen to the quality of conversation, and you realize it's as if there was never a Yom Kippur. Nothing's changed at all. What is it? Because we're trying an artificial thing. We're trying to change, and we think that we've gone through this magical process called Yom Kippur, and we come out the other side a chicken. It doesn't work like that. The only process that can affect the way we are is by altering what's nourishing us. That's what determines who we are. What is our source of input? What are we taking into ourselves? Because what we're absorbing, what we're being nourished by, is what's going to determine who we really are. The kind of culture, the kind of values, the kind of thinking that we're being nourished by, that determines who we become. That determines the way we operate. That determines the way we conduct ourselves and the way we function. And if we understand that, then we understand that the being religious, being frum, whatever that means, doesn't help going through a process of now I do things that I didn't before about tshuva. They talk about tshuva today. What's about tshuva? So instead of not keeping Shabbos, now he keeps Shabbos. Instead of not keeping kashrus, now he keeps kashrus. Very nice, but that's the same kind of thing that the Zohar talks about shaping a piece of stone. So you've taken the stone and you've reshaped it, but the stone is the same. The only time it's going to become different is if one realizes that a human being is not a stone, that a human being is a living organism, and what he is going to be determined by what's nourishing him, not just by what he does, but by what's nourishing him. The process of tshuva is attaching ourselves to sources of nourishment that are different to the ones that used to be before. If we're being nourished by the SABC TV and by the Star newspaper, and that's what's nourishing us, okay, it's one kind of person. If we're going to be nourished, if we're going to be nourished by what's going on around us, that's our source of input, that's what determines how we're thinking, that's one kind of human being. If we can detach ourselves from that, and detachment doesn't mean that we don't associate with that, detachment just means that we don't imbibe that, that we don't absorb that, that doesn't become part of us. But what nourishes our thinking, what nourishes our process of being, is Torah. That affects who the human being really is. And by nourishing the process of being again, I don't mean that one goes through the technicalities of reading and translating a text of Torah. That doesn't change the human being either. That's just another mechanism that one goes through. But where one's thinking process, where one's method of thinking, where one's method of understanding and analyzing is constantly being nourished from a Torah source, then whether one's reading the newspaper, or one's watching the television, or you're watching people interact, or you're watching sport, or you're doing nothing, whatever it is, that then becomes your method of integrating what you're seeing, integrating what you're learning. The integration process is the Torah, and by the time you've taken it into yourself, you've taken it into yourself as Torah. Once you're being nourished by Torah, that's a different kind of tree altogether. That's the process of conversion of a non-Jew to a Jew, and that's the process of conversion of an ordinary person to a higher level. Not a conversion of conduct only, but a conversion of input, what the human being is taking into himself. Perhaps the most important aspect of that process is recognizing a source of input, both negative and positive. As long as a person goes around thinking, I'm a Jew, everything's fine. So good, we've spoken about before this difference between being technically Jewish and being essentially Jewish. Yes, a person's born of a Jewish mother, he's converted according to the halacha, he's a Jew, it's correct. But that's not what being Jewish means. It says, I'm a Jew, there's a difference when you say, I'm a Jew, or you say, I'm Jewish. It's a difference. A person says, I'm Jewish, in what way is he Jewish? What is his input? That's what you've got to be looking at. What is his input? And perhaps the laws of kashrus have something to do with it. On a very simple level, yes, the laws of kashrus, food is, we take into ourselves, and therefore what we eat affects who we are. That's on one level. But it's much more than that. It's to teach us the principle that what there is an importance in what you're taking in, not just what you're putting out. Because what you're putting out is going to be a function of what you've taken in. And so just as in the area of food, the input is governed by the Torah, so in all areas, what you're taking in needs to be governed by the Torah. It's a way of doing it. Kosher food doesn't mean there are certain things you can never eat. But as we've often mentioned, the Gemara gives all sorts of recipes to achieve the same taste with kosher ingredients. So the purpose of kashrus is not to restrict the experience of taste. There's nothing you can't get the taste of. You can taste it all. But it has to be prepared in a particular way. It has to be made of particular ingredients. So it is with other life experiences. There's no life experience from which the Jew is barred. It just has to be constructed in a certain way. It has to be prepared in a certain way. It has to be integrated in a certain way. So that when we absorb it, what we're absorbing is something that is of Torah nourishment and not something that is a foreign nourishment. It's something as diverse as it might be and as rich as it might be and as different as it might be, one person from another. The common element is that he's put it together in such a way that what he's taking into his being is something that's coming through Jewish civilization. It's coming through Torah civilization. That's the filtering process. The way we look at the world is using the civilization of Avraham Avinu. That the way we understand the world is using the civilization of Avraham Avinu. That the way we integrate what's happening in the world is using the civilization of Avraham Avinu. So that whatever it is that we're exposed to, it goes through the tree, through the trunk, and it comes up to the branch at the end of the tree, and finally to the little twig, or to the little leaf that we are, having gone through the whole process of being integrated in the tree of Avraham Avinu, then it comes to our little leaf. Then we're part of that tree. My father always used to tell how his uncle Reb Elia used to say to his Talmidim, and if you want to repeat a shiur of mine, you can do so with pleasure, he used to tell them. And you don't even have to quote my name. The only condition that I make with you is that you don't make such a mess of it that I can never use it again. Before you use anything I say, he used to say, it has to go through every pipe of your body and every vein, every artery, before you say it. Don't just hear it from me and repeat it. Hear it from me and absorb it and integrate it and digest it. And then when you say it over again, it's yours, it's not mine anymore. That's what we do with everything that happens. Everything we see. We see an event. But what we make of that event, how we integrate it, how we digest it, how we absorb it, that everybody, each person differs from the other, and each culture differs from the other. And what we have to make sure is that whatever we're integrating into our beings is processed by the tree of Avraham Avinu, it's processed by Jewish civilization, by Torah civilization, that we don't take in food that is not kosher, that we don't take in intellectual food, emotional food, mental food, spiritual food that has not been prepared in accordance with the way the Torah wants us to absorb it, so that what it produces in us remains authentically Jewish. Once we understand it that way, we understand what teshuva is, and we understand what gerus is, we understand what conversion is. But we need to be able to identify, we need to be able to look at something and say, that's not Jewish, that's not Torah. How do I use it? How do I modify it? How do I react to it? How do I respond to it in a Torah way? What do I do with it? If we don't recognize what is Torah and what isn't Torah, it's impossible to respond correctly. And likewise, we also have to be able to identify positive inputs. Now, identification is becoming a difficult thing because discernment has become something that human beings are losing the ability to do. People are judging things by labels. If the label says it's good, then it's good. If the label doesn't say it's good, it's not good. And you've got it. We joke about it in Jewish circles, but it's exactly the same in regular commercial circles. People listen to adverts and they listen to packaging. Whatever it says, it's high quality, good, it's high quality. I was selling pearls to somebody when all the good pearls that come from Japan, it says on them H quality. So I was trying to sell to a particular jeweler, he wouldn't buy a thing from me. It took me years to find out why. He says, I don't buy H quality, I only buy A quality. I had to explain to him, they're all H quality, there's no such thing as that. You like A quality? He says, yes, I took off the label and I wrote A quality. Yeah. He says, okay, that he's prepared to look at. We buy labels, we don't buy objects because we don't develop the ability to look at the thing for ourselves and decide whether it's good or bad, irrespective of what the label says. That's why everything has to have a hechsher on it nowadays. There are two reasons. The one reason is that the food production has become a complex technology, and it's not easy for the man in the street to know what's kosher and what isn't kosher. But there are limits. When you start getting hechshers on bottles of water, things have gone a bit too far. That's a little bit too much. That means I can't drink the water unless it has a hechsher on it. Because I don't know if it's kosher. It's got to have a label. We need to develop the ability to discern and to notice what is Torah and what isn't Torah. And things are not always what they look. Sometimes things look like Torah and they're not. Sometimes things don't look like Torah and they are. There's this fellow, what's his name, Michael Jackson coming. I haven't listened to the words that he sings, and I haven't listened carefully to the music, but to me it doesn't sound terribly different to some of the psukim, some of the Jewish music that they sing at weddings. It doesn't sound very different. And I only realized that fully when I was at a non-religious wedding in Israel not so long ago, and there was a band playing and some vocalists, very good vocalists. None of them were Jewish. And the best of the vocalists was an African, it was a black man. He was singing all sorts of songs, and there was a band playing, and it was an orchestra, not a band. But it was magnificent. And then he started singing Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, all the tunes that we sing. And the people were rock and rolling to the tunes. It made no difference to them what he was singing. It he was singing it. It fits in. To take a posuk and to put it to music which is not subtle music doesn't make the music kosher. Just because the words are Shema Yisrael. There's no difference. Sometimes you get music, so you'll get people who say, they won't listen to Mozart, it's not Jewish music. They won't listen to Bach, it's not Jewish music. But if you take Michael Jackson's music and you put some psukim to it, that's Jewish music. All of a sudden that becomes, because it's got the right label. We can't judge things by labels, we've got to have the ability to discern what is nourishing, what is kosher for us, and what isn't kosher for us. That's the process of Torah study. To be able to develop the capacity to look at something independently and say, this is kosher or this isn't kosher. And if it's not, this is how it has to be prepared in order to make it kosher. Some animals we can't eat at all. Other animals we can eat provided it's properly prepared. Some things we can't do at all. Other things we can do provided we do it in the right way. The Jew has to be able to do that. And the process of identifying is part of what this whole passage that the person has to say when he brings the Bikurim is all about. What does he say? He says what's happening. Because if he wouldn't actually say it, he wouldn't think. What does he say? He guided Yahum Lashem Elokecha. I've told God today that I have come to the land which he swore to my fathers. And you shall say, back you go to the whole story. My father, an Aramite, wanted to destroy my father, and he went down to Egypt. And the whole story, there we became slaves, and we suffered terribly. And God took us out of there and gave and brought us to this land and gave us this land flowing of milk and honey. And now I have brought the first of my fruits which you gave me, Hashem, Nosato li Hashem. The source of the nourishment is you, God. You've got to realize that. You've got to recognize this is a typical case of taking an object which is going to nourish and deciding whether it's going to be Jewish nourishment or not. If you say this is Hashem, Nosato li Hashem, I recognize that this comes from God. That's going through a Jewish nourishment process. If you're going to eat the fruit without realizing that it comes from God, that's not going through a Jewish nourishment process. And the Rambam says in explaining this mitzvah in the Mori Nevuchin, in Lamed Tes of Chelek Shlishi, that this whole process is Midas HaAnova, is designed to introduce modesty into people. Ki hu shelokeh chasal al k'tefo. First thing is he has to carry this basket on his shoulders. And the same then applies no matter who you are. You can be the greatest Talmid Chacham, you can be the chief rabbi, you can be the prime minister, you can be the king. It doesn't make any difference. Every Jew takes a basket on his shoulders. V'yesh bo ha'akoro b'chastei Hashem v'namu, and you recognize the kindness of God and His pleasantness. She'yedo ha'odom ki min ha'avoido, because it's important for man to know that an aspect of the service of God is... Interesting, when we think of the service of God, we think of davening and we think of going to shul and learning Torah. So it's important to know that one of the dimensions of the service of God is Shiyizkor Yamei Mitzukosoi Bizman Shiyir Vachle. That when you've got it good, you remember what it was like when you had it bad. That's an important part of living. That you don't forget what it felt like when you had it bad. The Inyan Zeh Mudgash Batoira Harbe. And this concept is emphasized many times in the Torah. But it's important when you're having it good that you remember the bad, because only then do you realize that there's been nourishment. If when you finished a meal, you don't stop for a moment and think what you felt like before you started the meal, you don't notice you've eaten. That's why people get up from the table without saying thank you to the hostess. That's why they get up from the table without benching. They're actually not aware of the fact that they've been nourished. They've forgotten that they were ever hungry. Actually, that's the way we are. It's a funny thing. When you're hungry, you forget what it's like to be satisfied. And when you're satisfied, you forget what it's like to be hungry. And that can happen in minutes. In absolute minutes it can happen. In seconds. A change comes over a person and he forgets what it was before. And if you forget the change, if you forget the gap between what was and what is, there's a lack.